Okay, tonight, this week's Parsha is Parsha's Baal Lotecha, and there's so much, it's a very rich Parsha. You can look back, we've had different classes on a whole wealth of topics within the Parsha. But tonight, we're doing something which is actually relevant to right now. The class is titled, Do We All Have to Make Aliyah? Which means, do we all have to immigrate to Israel? The reason I bring this up is that a very unusual and consequence of COVID-19 has been, according to the Jewish Agency and Nefesh B'Nefesh, the two organizations that are involved in immigration to Israel, they might want to hazard a guess of what level of increase is the Jewish Agency and Nefesh B'Nefesh finding for people living in America who are registering to start the process to make Aliyah. Who wants to guess from this year to now, what is the increase of applications and interest in making Aliyah? Anybody want to take a guess? Okay, well, you both said the same time, so all right. So Scott and Sean, go ahead.
20%.
Sean, what do you say?
I'll go 50.
50% is correct.
Oh.
It's a 50% increase. It's a dramatic increase. Now, I ask you the question, now, why do you think that is?
A better run government.
Okay. One. What else? What do you guys say?
I think just a higher standard of living. Aren't they like always like in the top 10 of like happiest nations on earth?
I mean, we've all been to Israel. We know that you can have a good life there. But you would imagine that most Israelis make a third of what Americans make.
I think it's a matter of last resort. Instead of like your back to, it can be like your back to, like, you know, a matter of last resort. You know, you go to a Jewish country and hope that they'll take you in. Or people wanted to do this, and now with COVID-19, that everything sort of came to a halt and people lost their jobs and stuff, it's like, all right, I guess I don't have anything to tie me down. Time to live the old dream. I think it's one of the two.
Okay, so I think those are all, I mean, obviously for each individual person, it's going to be different. It could be a person of, like, they got laid off. They've been stuck in their house or apartment for already 3 months. They see that Israel has really done an effective job with remediating and managing the corona crisis. And like, you know, what's so awesome about, and then, I don't know if you guys did not notice it, but you know, we had like sort of like a race riot last week. Okay. You may not have noticed that. We had the tragic murder of George Floyd, which set off, peaceful protests against police brutality and clearly racism. Then, of course, it got involved, whether it's what percent are people who are then saw an opportunity to take advantage of the situation and then use an opportunity to loot and pillage, which happened, of course, in both in extreme ways, of course, in Manhattan and, of course, in Los Angeles. And, and of course, there's the, before all this, we had a rise in anti-Semitism. The person was like, I can't leave my apartment. The economy is in the toilet. We have a race riot. What is so awesome about being in America? Maybe it's time, to when that opens up, get on an LL flight and say, see ya, and move on. So apparently, 50% more people than last year, this year, are doing just that. So we shall see. Now, but I want to get to a sort of a halachic / ethical question. As Jews, do we all have to make Aliyah? You know what I mean? It's something that I'm sure everybody thought about maybe for a moment. We're going to get to that. We're going to explore that. Obviously, but I want to, our goal tonight is just to under, and ironically, this issue actually is a conversation in the Parsha, which makes, of course, it more interesting. So, of course, we'll start with a video, because that's what we do. All right, let's go to the, as they say, let us go to the videotape. Okay, this is a Rabbi Shalom Gold. Rabbi Shalom Gold made Aliyah. He was a successful rabbi in America and made Aliyah. And he put together his a video, and you'll hear it. Here we go. I'm not going to watch all 8 minutes. We'll watch most of it. Here we go.
I remember my wife and I saw, we were in Borough Park for a visit. We were on 13th Avenue. This goes back at least 20 years, 25 years. And we bought, there was a new tape that came out. Now, for the people who are listening, they may not know what a tape was. There was once a time that there were things called cassettes, you understand? And there was a cassette of a Jewish singer. On here was, I loved it, especially my name was in it. Oh, Jerusalem of gold, where I'll be bold and I'll be sold. I'm eating and head. I'm aching and yearning to. So my wife, we're driving. My wife says, "No, you're aching so much to come." And then we hear the last sentence, "When Mashiach comes, when Mashiach comes, we're going to go." Number one, I think those people are in for a big surprise. I don't think they're going to get any free trips by Mashiach. I don't think they're going to want to go to Mashiach. When Mashiach comes, he's going to have to drag them. As my good friend Nachman Kahana writes in a beautiful piece of his, he writes about his family in America, that's a beautiful Seder, you understand, a beautiful, beautiful Seder. And their sons and their daughters and their sons-in-law and their daughters-in-law, the carpet, you're going to even sink into the carpet, the chandelier is mashal. And Rabbi Kahana's story is about this fellow has a brother who lives in Eretz Yisrael, and one of his children, Erev Pesach, had to cross the border into Lebanon after terrorists, and in a foxhole someplace in Lebanon, he's eating his manot of matzah that they gave for him and his four cups of wine. And his cousins are over there and are dancing away in America. And then at the end of the meal, they get up and they're singing Lashonah above Yerushalayim. And he sees his wife is crying. "Why are you crying?" He says, "Next year, Yerushalayim, we're going to have to give this all up." "Oh, don't worry. It's only a song. Eretz Yisrael isn't only a song. Eretz Yisrael is the reality of Jewish life for now and forever." And I don't know how people can simply say, "Wait for Mashiach." Chazon Ish writes in one line, "Ukvar hukhra ha'alocha." The halacha has already been decided, like the Rambam and the Rambam that, and Shar Poskim and the others, that it's a mitzvah saseh to live in Eretz Yisrael now. V'yodua, and it's known. Kamoshav ha'chofetz chayim lalo sa'atza, ha'vich the chofetz chayim yearned and longed to go up to Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, that's the end of the one-liner in the Chazon Ish. And the fact is that the Chofetz Chaim had purchased an apartment in Petach Tikva, was planning on coming on Aliyah. And then somebody took ill in the family. He couldn't do it. He wasn't able. He was not Zeicher. But we are Zeicher. We are Zeicher. We can do it. We can do it. Anyway, I am fond of telling this story.
Okay, you got the basic drift. All right. So here we go. So what belief do many many observant Jews have concerning making Aliyah to Israel? You know, American Jews. What do people believe?
You'll be closer to you know, closer to God, closer to Hashem.
Well, do they, I mean, do they, what's their attitude toward it? Or is it, so they think it's a good thing? It's an optional thing? It's not, you know. Now, he, just to back up, Rabbi Gold said a story. I don't know if you guys heard it in the, through the video, of this family in, you know, in, you know, a family who's enjoying, shall we say, you know, wealth and opulence in America. And they come to the end of the Seder when we say, what? Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim, next year Jerusalem. And the wife is crying. You know, I don't want to give all this up. So, and then the guy says, don't worry about it. It's only a song. So what do people, what do many, not all, observant Jews feel about making Aliyah to Israel? Adrian, what do you think? You're on mute.
So do Americans think about doing Aliyah to Israel? It depends. Orthodox Jews?
Yeah, Orthodox Jews.
You know, it's sort of like a thing that you sort of know that Israel is foundational to the whole Jewish faith and it's central in our religion. But, you know, like I think about when I was in Colombia and we would go to a Chabad school. And like, you know, like we would go there, but we wouldn't, and we would do Shabbat, but we wouldn't keep kosher, we wouldn't keep Shabbat, because that's sort of like what the rabbi with the long beard does. And I think it's sort of like a similar type of situation where we sort of like live in this gray area where we sort of know that we should be in Israel, but we don't want to be in Israel. And so we're just like in this cognitive dissonance type of mental state where we just don't talk about it so much, you know, like, let's conclude this class and let's go to the next one. I think it's that sort of thing.
So, all right, so here's a, well, that gets into the, that feeds very nicely into question number two. Why don't more American Jews make Aliyah? Now, here's my question before, I'm gonna squeeze in another question before that question. How many Jews made Aliyah last year from North America? Yeah, I'm taking guesses. What do you guys say?
8,000.
Okay. What do you guys think of next? All right, Suzanne.
Twelve thousand.
Okay. So we have 8,000. We have 12,000. All right, Adrian.
I have no clue. I'm going to say 11,999.
Okay. Go ahead.
Right.
I
was
going to
say, so it's
1,000.
1,000?
Who said 1,000?
I'm going for 999.
Okay. So, just to give you the latest numbers, in 2018, 3,399 Olim. That is the United States and Canada. Of the 3,000, no, so 3,052. And 347 from Canada. Now, how many Jews are in America? About 5 million, 5, 6 million. So it's like insignificant amount. So clearly the numbers are in. They might talk a good game that Aliyah is very important, but they ain't doing it. We're all not doing it. Comments? Questions?
Seems about right. People were like, oh, maybe one day I'll make Aliyah. It's a nice aspirational thing, but once you start going through the process of the paperwork and rabbi, it's a lot.
But let's go deeper. So the question is, why only does 3,000-4,000 make Aliyah from America a year? Notice, remember, so if I say 50% more, that means it can go from 3,000 to 4,500. It's not a dramatic shift. The 50% number was sort of like a tease. Say they are. So number what?
Most people, they don't have family. Then.
Okay, so number one, so basically you're starting to list all the difficult things it is about making Aliyah. Number one, my family lives here. They do not live there. It's very hard to leave family. That's number one. What else?
Safety.
Say it again. I'm concerned about violence. I mean, it's funny to say that we're in America, but we feel you might your person might feel more unsafe in Israel. Now, I'm not sure statistically that holds true, whatever, but it feels it might feel to some as being more unsafe. What else? What other
employment?
In other words, it might be hard. Now, first of all, even though that Israel has done a tremendous job of mitigating and the COVID virus epidemic there, still. As of like a couple weeks ago, a full 26% of the workforce was out of work. So now, as they open up, people are going to go back to work. It'll be more that 25% will shrink. But still, the economic damage of COVID, is going to be tough everywhere. And it's tough in Israel. If it's tough in America, it's even going to be tougher in Israel. All right, what else?
Language,
huge. If you're going to make Aliyah, now it's not true in ours.
They offer classes, don't they?
Yeah, if you make Aliyah and with Nefesh B'Nefesh, you get money and you get certain rights and you get free education of what they call it Ulpan. Okay, so but it is hard if you're in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s to start to learn new language. It's not your prime time of language acquisition. Now, as you those who have been in Israel, there are certain places in Israel where you could basically pretty much only speak English. There are people who made Aliyah 30 years ago and still have shockingly bad Hebrew. Why? Because they hang out with Americans and therefore they're not forced to improve their Hebrew. And it's hard to learn a language. And some people are very gifted at it. And some people really want to work at it. And some people are like, no, don't bother me. I'm just going to tell you, I'm speaking English, deal with it. Okay, and there are communities in Jerusalem you can speak English the whole time. There'll be people that can have a little difficulty, but more and just the opposite. An Israeli hears an English speaker, it's an opportunity. Because great, I have somebody I can practice my bad English on you. So they love an English speaker. All right, if you live in more in the hinterlands where if you live in Ranana, you live in Modi'in, you live in Chashmonaim, you live in Tel Aviv, there are many places which have huge, huge quantities of people who are English speakers. So you can actually, you can learn let's call it Fellowship Israel Trip Hebrew, a little teeny amount of Hebrew and get by a long time with that. But if you want to be fully integrated in the community society, yes, you got to learn the language, and it's a hassle. Some people love it. Some people it's just annoying. So those are a lot of good reasons. Now, I don't know if you caught this. You sort of mentioned the story in passing. First of all, do you guys know who the character of the story, the Chafetz Chaim, was? Have you heard that name, the Chafetz Chaim? No, I'm getting some yeses. I'm getting some noes. You heard a lot of times. Okay.
Less than a day.
Right. So, now, his name was not the Chafetz Chaim. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. He passed away in 1933 in the town of Radin in Belarus in Eastern Europe. And basically, he's called the Chafetz Chaim because he wrote a book called the Chafetz Chaim. He also wrote a book called the Mishnah Brura, which is a commentary on the first of the four volumes of the Shulchan Aruch. And he wrote lots of books. And he was just known as what they call, in simple terms, a great tzaddik. He was a master of Jewish law and a person who really was one of the most influential members of the Musar movement, ethical. There's a Musar movement, which we've talked about in the past, but very significant. But if you don't know who he is, you just get onto Wikipedia just to get sort of like a little overview of who he was. So the Chafetz Chaim, what Rabbi Gold shared, says, wanted to make Aliyah. He purchased an apartment in Petah Tikva, but then one of his close relatives got ill and he had to tend to them, and therefore he could not make Aliyah. He was sort of like, it just didn't work out. Okay. So let me ask you a little question. But what does that story tell you, that here we have the Chafetz Chaim, who is the, you know, shall we say, the quintessential righteous, knowledgeable Jew, who tried to make Aliyah, but then did not make Aliyah? What does that teach you about Aliyah itself? It's just a very basic deduction.
Not for everyone.
Right. There are circumstances where you don't have to go or you don't have to do it. Obviously, if everybody held there was unquestionably, you know, if making Aliyah was like keeping Shabbos, which had to be like, you know, it's 100%, you got a thing, then there would be everybody would have to be in Israel. But that's clearly not the case. Now, we should get to our interesting question. Is there a good reason not to make Aliyah?
Didn't the Rebbe have a stance that we didn't, I mean, I know he's not everything, but that we didn't have to, but I don't remember why he said.
Okay, so let me share with you sort of like we're going to get into sort of like, this is actually, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on sort of the halachic issue on this. And then we're going to go into the story of Moshe and his father-in-law, Yitro, or he's called in this story, Chovav. And we're going to get into it. But there's a debate among the Rishonim, the medieval scholars, is there a positive mitzvah to make Aliyah? Famously, Nachmanides, the Ramban, held there was. There's a positive mitzvah to make Aliyah, which he himself was only able to fulfill later in his life. He immigrated to Israel later in his life. The Rambam, he does not, he has an interesting formulation. He does not say there's a positive, of his count of 613, he does not count it as one of the 613 mitzvahs to live in Israel. He has an interesting formulation. He says, but if you do live in Israel, it's forbidden to what? We actually did a couple weeks ago when we did about the story of Ruth. What are you prohibited? If you move to Israel, what are you not allowed to do? Any guesses? All right, Adrian?
What you're not supposed to do?
If you, according to the Rambam, if you actually move to Israel, what are you not allowed to do then? Right, you're not allowed to make what they call Yirida. You're not allowed to leave Israel. Unless he has a couple of caveats. And here are the things. You're leaving Israel because you need to learn Torah. And there's a special school or rabbi that works better for you. A. B. You leave on an extended business trip. You need to make money. You can't make money there. 3. It's not safe, going to Sean's point. You know, they're hurling rockets from Gaza or from wherever. Or 4, you need to leave because you need to find a shidduch. You need to get married, and you're not having success in Israel. But after you accomplish those things, then you got, according to the Rambam, you got to come back. So that's the debate. But many, you know, everybody agrees it's a good thing to go. And I'll sort of summarize the whole conversation very simply. All things being equal, a person should live in Israel. All things being equal. What we're going to go into tonight, for the rest of our remaining of our time, we're going to extrapolate from Moshe's conversation with Yitro some of the considerations, some of the thoughts that would inform somebody not to make Aliyah. Okay, that Aliyah for them may not be for them. Okay, so let me get into the psukim here. We're going to read the psukim. I'm going to do a share screen. Here we go. Sean, can you read the psukim? Can you see the psukim?
Yes.
All right, read them out.
10:29. Moshe said to his father-in-law, Chovav, son of Reuel, the Midianite, we are now on our way to the place that Hashem promised to give us. come with us, and we'll let you share the benefit of all the good things that Hashem has promised Israel.
All right, so before we go on, now, what is Yitro's... What is Moshe's father name, more common name?
Yitro.
So Yitro has seven names, which is an interesting thing. Which, you know, why he's called that? But I don't want to. You know, that's a good question. I don't want to tick on that point. But that just you should know that Yitro is also called Chovev. He's also even called Reuel. Whatever. He's a guy who has many names. He's also called Kaney. So he's got a bunch of names. I just want to make sure you guys are aware of that. So in this story, he's called Chovev. Okay.
Is there a particular reason why in this particular situation that name is used?
Rashi gives a possibility. Just to give you I'll take a little peek over here. I'll go to a little share screen. I mean, just so you see, guys, do you guys see what I'm doing here? This is Safaria. This is an advance. You got to take advantage. By the way, Kevin at MJE. Anybody know Kevin from MJE?
Yeah.
He works for Safaria. So right now we're using his website. And next time you see him, you should say, hey, we used your website. So Rashi says he's called Chovev. Right here. Chovev, because the word Chovev means to love also, because he loved the Torah. All right, so he's called a different name. So here, we're going to find out. This is already after Yitro, a.k.a. Chovev, has been with Moshe for about a year, learning Torah at Mount Sinai with him. So we're going to go back to the sheet. I'm sorry about what was second wrong. Okay, take it away.
Okay.
So Moshe says, hey, we're on our way to the place that God promised us to give us. Come with us, and you can come, and you're going to get good things too. Go on.
I will not go, replied Chovev. I will rather return to my land and my birthplace. Do not abandon us, said Moshe. After all, you are familiar with the places where we are going to camp in the desert, and you can be our guides. And if you go with us, we will share with you whatever good Hashem grants us.
Okay, so... All right, so... So how was Moshe's attempt? Does Yitro end up going with them?
No.
He does not. Okay, so can you imagine telling the master of all prophets, no? Just think about it. All right, let's get a little Rashi action just to get a little more of a context to flesh out the story a little more. Go ahead.
We are now on to the place. Immediately, within 3 days, we shall enter the land of Canaan. They said this because on this first journey after leaving Sinai, they really set out with a view to entering the land of Israel, only that they sinned at the incident of those who complained, which prevented their further progress. But why did Moshe include himself with them in the statement, we are journeying to enter the land? Because the decree that he should not enter it had not yet been made regarding him, and he was yet under the belief that he would enter.
Excellent. So you have to understand the scene. The Jewish people, they left Egypt, right? They travel 49 days, they get to Mount Sinai. Moshe's up there for 40 days, they got a little problem called the golden calf, that was a little bit of delay. Moshe comes down ultimately on Yom Kippur, the Jews are forgiven, and they're involved in two things. Building the Mishkan, building the tabernacle, A, and B, learning the Torah. Moshe teaches the Torah to the people. Okay? And they're learning, that's from October through basically June. ER. So ER is May, June. All right? So Yitro came seemingly before that. So he was there for most of the time. Now, Moshe, Hashem says, all right, guys, you got the Mishkan, you got the Ten Commandments, you got a good, where are we going now? We're going to the land of Israel. And who's going to take him in? Moshe's taking him in. Now, you know the rest of the story, but right now Moshe is full of enthusiasm. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitcher says he'd always tear up by this verse. When the verse, we are now on his way. He's sort of like, there's Moshe's enthusiasm. He thinks he's, you know, he's just like the goal of his life of bringing the Jewish people into the land of Israel, creating a Jewish sovereignty, building the temple, you know, conquering the land, creating a Jewish state is within his grasp. 3 days away. 3 day away journey from the border. So close. And then, as you know, in the next chapter, chapter 11, these people start to complain. They complain about the man. They complain about the meat. It's like the whole thing starts to unravel like a disaster. And, of course, next week's parsha, you have the episode of the spies, where the Jews, are, you know, 12 spies come back, 10 spies come back with a bad report, and the Jews then are marooned as punished for 40 years in the desert. And in that being, in addition to being marooned in that desert, is Moshe, and he never enters the land. But right now, he's so optimistic, and he wants to bring his dear old father-in-law. Come on down! It's going to be awesome! Okay? Alright, does everybody have the scene? Alright, now, let's do a couple of questions over here. How old do you think Yitro was? The Torah does not tell specifically his date, his age, but roughly, how old do you think Yitro is?
80.
Well, Moshe's 80. Moshe left Egypt. It says he's 80. Moshe married one of his seven daughters. I mean, it's conceivable that Moshe was older than Yitro, but clearly Yitro's not no. He ain't no youngster.
Okay. Over 100 then.
I don't know if he's over 100. You know, he's definitely a senior citizen. We don't know. So you have to know the number one, Yitro, and our Moshe's 80, and Yitro's his father-in-law. You know, Yitro ain't no youngster. That's point number one. Question number two. What did Yitro have to do to get to go from Midian to Mount Sinai? Was that like an easy track for him? I mean, was that easy for him?
No, probably not.
Well, first of all, he could not, just to give you a little sense of the, I'm showing you the map here. So, Mount Sinai is around here. We don't know for sure the place. Here's here. And ancient Midian is on the southern part of the modern state of Jordan, opposite the Red Sea. So somewhere around here is Midian. We don't know. Above them is Edom, and above them is Moab. Moab, Edom, Midian. Okay? So this might only be 100 miles, right? But, as you can see, 100 miles, if you're an old guy, we know how he traveled in. How did he travel into Mount Sinai? The Torah tells us back in the Parsha of Yitro. Anybody remember? What was the transportation of choice in the time of the Chumash? Anybody know? Anybody remember? What did Avram travel on? What did Bilam travel on? What? Say it again, I'm sorry.
Camel.
Camel? Interestingly, no. Camel.
Donkey
is correct. Donkey was the choice. There were very wealthy people had camels. So when Avram sent Eliezer, or his servant, to get a wife to go to Mesopotamia, he sent him with 10 camels. But that was equivalent of going with like 10... You know, that back then, that was like going on with 10, Cadillac Escalades, all right? Wealthy people had that. But most people had basically the equivalent of the Toyota Camry of the ancient world was the mule or donkey. Okay? So if you're driving the Camry, the Honda Accord, it's your basic donkey. Okay? So it was not so pleasant. I mean, you know, it's like, that would be like very fun to do that for 5 minutes at a petting zoo for 5 minutes to go around in a circle on a donkey. Not to travel for about 15, 20 days when you're like an 80-year-old dude. So, very hard. I'm just painting a picture here that what you try to do is not simple. Okay. Next question. Question number 7. Why was Yitro there with Moshe for a year? Who remembers? Why is Yitro there for a year? What's he doing? Or better yet, why did he even come in the first place? This is a Parsha test, guys. I know it's from the book of Shemot, the one in the book of Bamidbar. Why did Yitro come to visit Moshe? And then apparently stay for a year.
Well, did he already convert to like Judaism? He became...
Well, that's not open the text. That's how the rabbis understand that. How does a guy go from being a seemingly a pagan priest of the tribal state of Midian to a convert to Judaism or somebody who agrees with Judaism?
He heard about the miracles.
He heard about the miracles and he wanted to investigate it himself. He heard what occurred and he goes to his prime educator, somebody in the family, Moshe. Moshe tells him all the stuff in the tent. And then Yitro exclaims, he rejoices, and now I know there is no other God other than Hashem. And at that point, he offers sacrifices, and he has an epiphany. Now, the fact that he's hanging around, clearly, what does he decide to do? Is he just chilling with his son-in-law? Now, he did bring back his daughter and their two sons, his two grandsons. Why is he hanging out for a year? And if he is hanging out with them, why is he going to, you start the trip, finish the trip. Why is he then bouncing on them in the middle after 1 year of hanging out with them by Mount Sinai? What do you guys say?
He got tired?
But he only got tired when they're going to move. Why, but I'm saying, before he decided to leave, but why is he hanging out there for a year? Is it because he couldn't get off the couch? The equivalent of could not get off the couch for a year?
He kind of, maybe it was like a situation where he just kind of not lost faith, but he just kind of resided to, this is where I'm going to be for the rest of my life.
So why didn't he just go there, have a long weekend with Moshe, drop off his daughter Tzipporah, drop off the two sons, hear what the good news from Moshe, and say, "All right, great," and bounce back to Midian. Pull a Yui or the donkey, and then head on back to Midian. Why'd he stay? He stayed for a year. Because he comes into the story on chapter 18 in Shemot, which is before the giving of the Ten Commandments, and this is right after, about a year later. So he's hanging out with the family for a year. What's he doing? What do you guys say? Suzanne, what do you think Yitro's doing?
I feel like he was learning.
That's correct. That's a reasonable assumption because he's a seeker. He's a seeker of knowledge. And he decided, and what Sean said, and that's what we know, he converted. Either he converted, halachically he's a full Jew, or he is what they call a ger toshav, he's a Noahide. In other words, he abandoned his pagan ways, and he wants to learn about God and Judaism. Either as a full convert, or a convert away from idolatry. And so he's having he joined all the classes. Moshe's teaching, he's in the front row. So he's enjoying it. He's having a great time. Okay, so that just strengthened the question. Why would he not go back to... Why does he just go with them back, you know, to the land of Israel with them, and then, you know, why does he have to go back to Midian now? And there, by the way, this is a, just to give you a foreshadowing, this is a debate among all the Mephorshim. This is sort of a mystery. Why did Yitro not go? Okay, and then the mystery gets a little more intense. We'll show you the last Rashi at the end. But the question is, there's no clear answer. Why did Yitro turn down Moshe? Moshe was really trying to sell, was coming in hot. You know, it was going to be, you know, whatever the good stuff we get, you're going to get, it'll be great. And Moshe said, and Yitro says, no, I'm going back to my place. What happened? Where's the love? He's called Chovav, but there's no Chavivut, there's no love. How do you explain that? Anybody have a theory? Anybody have a possibility? I stumped everybody.
You want to spread the message back home.
Say, ah, Alex, thank you so much. So what Alex is suggesting, it's not that he's a bad guy, just the opposite. He has a family back in Midian. He says, you know, I have this great teaching. I have a great learning about Judaism. I want to take it home and inspire them. Get them on board. Excellent idea. Alex, 500 points in square for you. Well done. Okay, we continue on. So let's take a look at the Ralbag. I'm going to have somebody read the Ralbag. Let me have Suzanne.
I don't see the screen.
Oh, because you know why? Because I didn't share it. Okay, that's thank you for the, go ahead, go.
Okay, the eighth benefit of the story is that is it proper for all perfected people to help others perfect themselves as much possible?
As much as possible. Okay, I did a quick translation beforehand, which is basically what our good friend, Alex just said. As much as possible. Thank you. Okay, go on.
We see that even though Moshe had complete trust that Yitro's belief in Hashem, he was nervous that Yitro's family will remain in their pagan ways. Therefore, Moshe sought to have Yitro remain with the Jewish people in order that his family would join him and become engaged in the Jewish way. In order to sweeten the deal, Moshe promised him property in Israel, even though he was not from the tribes. Yitro did not listen to Moshe's counsel because Yitro was confident that he will be able to educate his family out of the pagan ways into a full acceptance of Hashem. We see that Yitro's family ultimately made Aliyah and allied themselves
with the Jewish people.
Was Moshe, did he have the power to give Yitro land?
That's a very good question. And so we see that apparently, we'll see, let's take a look at Rashi and we'll put it all together. All right, Sean, read Rashi, which is addressing your question.
And it shall be that what goodness the Lord shall do unto us, the same will we do unto thee. What good did they bestow upon him? I.e., when did they redeem their promise? Our sages say when the Israelites were parceling out the land, the most fertile part of Jericho proved to extend over an area of 500 by 500 cubits. They left it unparceled and said, he in whose portion of land the sanctuary will be built shall take it as a substitute for giving up the land upon which the temple was built. In the meantime, however, they gave it to the children of Yitro, to Yonadab, the son of Rahab, as it is said in Judges 1:16, and the children of the Kenite, Moshe's father-in-law, went up out of the city of the palm tree, which is identical with Jericho.
So apparently, getting to Sean's question, is that Moshe apparently, as essentially de facto the king, had a right, apparently, to dedicate land to to somebody who's not part of the tribes, not just any land, but the best land. Apparently, well, although they, way they were, the way that the Midrash says is that whoever, wherever they're going to be, the ultimate location of the Beit HaMikdash, whoever owns that land will have to give it up sort of to the community property of the temple, and they'll get the land, they'll get this piece of land in Yericho, which, by the way, some of the, when we went on our Israel trip, can't mention this enough, we were at Mitzpe Yericho, and we looked down upon, you know, biblical Jericho, which now, to this very day, is very fertile because it's one of the best producers of what fruit? Who remembers? This is a MJE Fellowship Israel trip. What fruit is grown in Yericho, which is world-renowned?
Olives?
Nope. They have olives there, but they have they grow something that are one of the best in the world. That land and the earth and the temperature and this and that, and they grow some of the most best of these fruit. I'll give you, it's one of the seven fruits of the land of Israel. It's dates. Oh. Dates. Some of the best. We drove by them, and they got the special way of growing the dates. The date trees are really short, so they don't require either a cherry picker to get the dates. I don't know if you remember that. If you guys looked outside the bus, they brought in this sort of Iranian species of dates, date palms, and they're very short, but they're very robust. I think they're medjool dates, very good, delicious dates. And that area has been producing fantastic dates for 4,000 or 5,000 years. So that's the land that Yitro's family ultimately went up, and they gave it to them. Okay. So apparently Moshe had authority, and he gave it to them. You know, ultimately gave it to them. Now, But what did Yitro's argument with Moshe? I just want to. This is really based upon Alex's answer. Alex intuited the Ralbog's answer. But what was the debate between Moshe? Why did Moshe want Yitro to stay with him and go up to the land of Israel? What was the goal? Anyone take Sean? Why did Moshe want Yitro to come with him to the land of Israel? According to the Ralbag. And I'll share screen the Ralbag. All right, anybody else? Anyway, why did, according to the Ralbag, why did Moshe want...
So Yitro's family would join them and would... be part of the whole Jewish culture.
And what did Yitro want to do?
He just wanted to go back and teach them in Midian.
And what did Moshe feel was not going to happen?
That Yitro's family wouldn't join him in his...
Right, so there was a debate of how successful Yitro would be by going home to Midian and teaching his family about Hashem and, you know, getting them on board. Moshe felt that's too risky. Better you stay here, they'll join you, and we'll give you some beautiful land as a, you're not going to lose out your land in Midian. You'll get a parcel of land when you go to the land of Israel. And this is the third time that we see that Yitro argues with Moshe. He argues with Moshe about the... he argues with Moshe about... you know, how to set up the court system. And here he argues with Moshe again, if you know who's going to be more successful. Now, ironically, we see in the book of Shoftim that his family, the Cainy tribe, because he's one of his most of Yitro's names, also called Cainy, actually immigrated and they became allies. Now, this is a very hard question, but I'm going to throw it anyways. What female heroine in the Bible comes from the Cainy tribe and therefore comes from Yitro? Which famous non-Jewish woman who's the heroine. Came from the Cain tribe, and ultimately comes from, is a descendant of, a direct descendant from Yitro. And the story's in Shoftim. The answer is Yael. You guys, of course, you know that name Yael is a very popular Jewish name, but actually Yael is not Jewish, and Yael brings in, there's a famous enemy of the Jewish people called, the general called Sisera, famous warrior. And he's running from the army, and he's running through their village, and she beckons him into her tent, and she gives him, you know, milk to drink, and she puts him in there in the bed, and says, "Don't worry, and I'll protect you," right? And what does she end up doing when he's asleep? Anybody remember? If you don't remember, you got to know the story. This is a story with Devorah and Barak and Sisera and Yael. Great characters. When he's asleep, she hammers a metal peg through his forehead into the ground, i.e. killing him. And then when the Jewish army shows up, she ushers him into the tent. Would you be looking for this guy? Okay. So, she may not have been Jewish, but she valued the Jewish people and willing to take on a rather dangerous task of essentially assassinating a mighty warrior, Sisera, direct descendant of Yitro. Okay. If you don't know that story, Google it, read that story. It'll take you 10 minutes. It's a juicy story. We read that story on the second day of Rosh Hashanah and the Haftarah. Okay? Just an FYI on that one. Okay. I got only 3 questions left of the night. According to the Ralbag, what is the value about being in Israel? Or better yet, why did Moshe encourage Yitro to make Aliyah? What was he trying to encourage him? What was the reason? What's the value? What do you guys say? Alex, what do you say, Alex?
Your mitzvahs are somehow more important, closer, relevant.
Well, there.
Besides the fact that there's an important being there.
So, but this is So here, there's no. In this part of the Chumash, there's no mention yet. The Jews are going to go to Israel because that's their command to go, but to make it sort of a universal mitzvah for all time does not seem to be mentioned just yet, but the Ralbag points out that from Moshe's argument there's an intrinsic value, at least then, which we can then extrapolate. What value was Moshe hoping to have occur in Israel, which he felt was not likely to occur in Midian? Adrian, what do you say? What was Moshe hoping to occur more effectively, more powerfully, in the land of Israel that would not be accomplished elsewhere, not in the land of Midian? What do you say?
No pass for this one, Rabbi.
Okay, Suzanne, what do you say?
I feel like he thought he would be able to teach the values and teach Judaism better if he was in Israel.
Exactly. In other words, if Yitro would come and therefore his family would come, it's much more of a chance that they would become complete and, either be Jews or followers of Hashem in a much more complete fashion. In other words, that Israel is instrumental to living a fuller, richer Jewish life. Okay, that was his theory. What did Yitro believe? What was Yitro's belief?
No, he had to go back and teach it back where he's from.
Well, he felt he could accomplish the goal in the hometown there, and neither he felt that they're not going to come, and he felt that he'll go there and he'll impact them there, which apparently he did. So, now, what did Moshe and Yitro agree about, and what do they disagree about? What is their what do they both agree about? What does Moshe and Yitro, from the perspective of the Ralbah, what do they both agree about, and what do they disagree about? What do you guys say? So they both agree about that the mitzvah, the goal of the going to Israel, is Israel a means or is Israel an end? I'll put the question: does Moshe and Yitro agree? Is living in Israel a means or an end? What do you guys say?
It's an end.
So that means that's the goal. Well, if that's the goal, then
the destination is to go into the land of.
Yeah, but Yitro doesn't agree with that.
I think they both see it as mean. I just think that they disagree as to the instrumentality.
Correct. In other words, the end is a relationship with Hashem. That's the destination. The destination is Hashem. Relationship with Hashem, learning about Hashem, becoming a better Jew, becoming educated, that's the end. Israel, Moshe is saying, what's the best tool of that? Moving to Israel. Because it's a whole society. It's a plan that Hashem promised the Jewish people. What is Yitro arguing? I agree with you, that's the end, but I don't need that instrumentality necessarily. Or my circumstance does not necessarily lend itself to that instrumentality. So, that gets to our last question of the night. In your own decision-making about Aliyah, what do you think Moshe would counsel you, and how would Yitro counsel you? It's a little bit hypothetical and theoretical, but what do you guys say? How would you use this rubric insofar as a conversation? So what would Moshe, based upon this perspective, what would Moshe say to all of us?
Moshe would say we need to go there.
We got to go. In other words, your Jewish life will only be better. I mean, you know, now obviously the situation is not the same as it was in the time of Moshe and Yitro, but using the same... Now Yitro would say, what would Yitro say to us?
Stay and teach...
Well, he would say, first of all, it depends on your situation. You know, it depends on you. In other words, the question is if, in other words, the goal, everybody agrees that the goal, the highest virtue in Judaism is not living in Israel. The highest goal is a relationship with Hashem, loving Hashem, believing in Hashem, trusting Hashem. Israel is a powerful tool, mitzvah tool, to accomplish that goal. So the question really is, now, it could be, for example, I'll just speak about myself, and I'll speak about Rabbi Wilds also. I've told Rabbi Wilds, you cannot make Aliyah. Why can you not make Aliyah? Because, first of all, he's teaching Torah to, you know, hundreds of people online, thousands of people. He's having an impact on the Jewish people in Manhattan here. He goes to Israel, that's not necessarily going to happen. So, he's teaching, he's causing people to, you know, his whole mission, his rabbin, and myself too, my students are here in America. I don't have any students in Israel. Well, I do have some MGers that made Aliyah. Proud of them, each and every one of them. But by and large, my students live here in the United States. So, and my learning situation here is all set up in America, and I have a good learning situation with various chavrutot. But having said that, it becomes a question about where will you, it comes down to a question, where will I grow more? Now, all the things that we brought up, well, there's a language issue, there's a livelihood issue. There's a family issue. There's all these variables. In other words, it's not one variable. So reality is, it's a complex equation to consider. Or that's why I said before, all things being equal, person should live in Israel. But there can be extenuating circumstances where it's not going to work for them. Okay?
Is it about where am I going to grow more, or is it about where am I going to have the greatest impact and positive impact on humanity?
For people who are teaching Torah, because teaching and learning are sort of like one, where you have impact is also where you grow as a learning wise. So I say where a person grows Jewishly. Now it could be that person it's not clear. So if it's not clear, then consider give Israel a shot. By the way, you don't have to go into the deep end. Many people, they take a half a year off, they go for a couple of months, they try it out. It's not an all or nothing kind of thing. So I would not advise that anyway. So there's a smart way to make Aliyah or to consider Aliyah if that's in your if you are considering that. My point being is it really depends. You know, as a person feels I don't have any contacts, I feel that I'm not going to have it. It's going to be very hard for me to get a job. I don't know the language. My Jewish community is here. I'm going to be there. I'm going to get lost. So those are real. Those are real things. It's not like simply just excuses. So you have to, balance that out. You know what I'm saying? It has to be a. In other words, what we're saying here is that, and what Moshe and Yitro both said, that the land of Israel is not a good in its own right. The goal, the end, if you will. The end destination really is a relationship with Hashem. Where will it be better? All things being equal, Israel is designed for that. Should be there. But there could be other external, other considerations that make that not a possibility. You know what I'm saying? So, as we read, we said the story before that Rabbi, the Chafetz Chaim, wanted to go to Israel. He actually bought an apartment. But he had family obligations. He could not leave his family. He had an ill relative. He had to take care, make sure the person was taken care of. He couldn't just say, see ya. So it's a complicated calculation. And it's something that's worthwhile discussing with, whoever you consider your spiritual advisor. Something, to consider about it. But many people in America are saying, Israel... free yeshiva, free day school, free health care, or very inexpensive health care, and free day school education. Already I'm ahead of the game. So, America's not so great with its anti-Semitism, race riots, and a COVID-19 epidemic. So, why not Israel? Why not give it a shot? And I would say they're right. You know what I'm saying? That's something to consider. So, but if you are considering Aliyah, you want to do it wisely. I wouldn't recommend just jumping into the deep end. I'd recommend starting from the shallow end and, planning it out. But one thing's good. MG's been around now 21 years, coming up to 22 years or 20, yeah, starting his 22nd year. We have many graduates, probably 50, 60 graduates that live in Israel. So already there's a community there. So there are people there that you can talk to, and I'm happy, I or Rabbi Wilds and Jill and Rabbi Ezra and everybody else can say, not to mention that we have Rabbi Jonathan Feldman there who lives in Beit Shemesh and is working with another community in Tel Aviv. So if you're interested, you can talk to me at a different time and we could talk about the possibility of that something to consider. But it's ironic that the debate is happening now for 50% more Jewish people in America and in Europe, A. And B, it's a conversation that Moshe and his father-in-law Yitro had in this week's Parsha. So it's a perfect combination. Any questions?
Well, I have a quick question.
Yeah, Sean.
The issue of making Aliyah within the Orthodox community is the issue of Aliyah irrespective of whether you're modern Orthodox, Yeshivish, Hasidic, that transcends where someone is within the Orthodox world? Irrespective of their view on the modern state of Israel? I guess that's more of my question.
Right, the mitzvah is not related to the modern state of Israel from a halachic standpoint, because the Ramban, who says that it is a positive commandment, lived in the 1200s. There was no modern state of Israel. And the Israel and the land of Israel that he made Aliyah to was rather inhospitable to Jews. There was, you're talking about a land that was devastated from three crusades. He just felt it was a mitzvah to live there. By the way, the story is that the Rambam also went there 100 years earlier, 50 years earlier, but he couldn't sustain himself because the community was so devastated by the Crusades. He went to, at that point, which in the region was the Jewish capital of the Middle East, which was Egypt, Alexandria and Cairo and those areas. So he couldn't make it. He couldn't. It was dangerous, and there's no way to make a livelihood there. So he didn't do it. But you're saying now, so there's a mitzvah anyway. But people who are religious Zionists feel that they view it, if you come from a Mizrahi standpoint, they view it as a central aspect of identity. The yeshivish world and the Hasidic world, by and large, I mean, there's 1 million Haredim living in Israel, so they live there. But they're not, so far as, they know about the mitzvah of Aliyah, but it's not a nationalistic component. In the modern Orthodox religious Zionist, it becomes also a nationalistic thing. You know what I'm saying? Not just a halachic thing, but a nationalistic thing. It becomes a political thing. You know what I'm saying? Not just a Jewish law thing. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. Makes sense.
So it's complicated, but that's the basic deal. Any questions? It's a big topic. All right, guys. Have yourself a wonderful night. Those who are in the senior fellowship class, you will have none other than Rabbi Joshua D. Klein tomorrow night. We'll be teaching. I'll get a title, and I'll send it out tomorrow. All right, cool. Guys. Have a great night.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You got it. Be well. Bye.